I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney is getting ready to announce a major push to repair and improve parks, recreation centers, and libraries across the city. WHYY's Katie Colinari reports that the initiative could define Kenney's first term in office.
Philadelphia has struggled to maintain parks, recreation centers, and libraries for decades. Take Vare Recreation Center in Grays Ferry. The building is more than 90 years old, and it's showing its age. Volunteer Tadita Covington takes me into the teen room where her three children attend a free summer camp.
As you can see, the furniture is stained and it's torn. The carpets are stained and the paint is horrible. They need new tables and chairs to hold the children. That's supposed to be the sink, and the sink doesn't work.
She says in warmer months, water bugs crawl through the holes in the windows.
It shouldn't be this way, but you don't want to tell your kids, oh, don't come to camp, because this is happening, because that's the only outlet that they have.
Besides, it's the only summer program Covington can afford. What she and Alfred Walker, who runs the basketball program here, don't understand is why other recreation centers in the city have it much better.
Myself, I live up in West Oak Lane, Mount Airy, and the recreation center that we have up there, like Emmanuel, that place is elegant compared to here. You know, you think you're in a castle. You know, really, you have multiple courts in the indoors and brand new floors. Like, you sit back and look here. Look at these floors. Look at this. You see that there? Floor like they're ready to come up.
Rec centers where communities have the means to get deeply involved tend to function better. Mayor Jim Kenney says that's why he's proposing an ambitious and expensive overhaul of these public spaces, which will start with places like Vare that have a longer way to go.
When we have a football league, you know, in South Philadelphia, where we have suburban people come into our communities and look at what our kids have to play with, and then our kids go out to the suburbs and play in pristinely manicured fields, I mean, it makes us feel like second-class citizens, and we're not.
And it's not just parks and rec centers that need help. Last year, several of Philadelphia's libraries were closed for the entire summer because of broken air conditioning systems. For many low-income children in the city, that meant no summer reading programs or free lunches.
This investment will give people in every community a sense of equity and fairness that we care about them and we value them as citizens.
Kenney will outline the plan during his budget address next week. To pay for it, he wants to sell $300 million worth of city bonds, and he anticipates more than $100 million from private foundations. Add in state and federal funds, and the hope is for a grand total of $500 million over 6 years. Investing in these public spaces will dovetail with Kenney's other big proposals, like creating community schools and a universal pre-K program. Managing Director Mike DeBerardinis, who ran the Parks and Recreation Department under former Mayor Michael Nutter, says the plan is about more than just replacing an old boiler here or putting in a new basketball court there. DeBerardinis wants to make big investments that'll change entire neighborhoods. For example, after $5 million worth of improvements in Hunting Park, he says crime in an area once popular with drug dealers went down almost 90%.
We have lots of scores of examples when we've done it right where it has been transformational. You transform the facility, you can transform the neighborhood, you can transform lives.
DeBerardinis says some facilities could start seeing money for improvements as early as next year. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
A Pennsylvania Supreme Court justice still faces misconduct charges stemming from his involvement in offensive email, despite reports that the case might be settled without a trial. WHYY's Dave Davies reports.
The state's Judicial Conduct Board has charged Justice Michael Aiken with violating the Code of Judicial Conduct, citing scores of emails with pornographic, racist, and homophobic content. The case was to be tried before the State Court of Judicial Discipline, but it was expected that a resolution of the case might be presented at a hearing today. Presiding Judge Jack Pinella, though, refused to let Aiken's attorney discuss any proposed settlement, saying the case will move forward. Another justice involved in the so-called Porngate scandal, Seamus McCaffrey, was allowed to resign in 2014 in a deal that let him avoid formal charges and keep his state pension. That agreement drew criticism, and Aiken now appears headed for a public trial. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
After outsourcing its substitute teaching services to a private firm, the School District of Philadelphia is having more trouble, not less, finding subs willing to lead classrooms. School-by-school data obtained by WHYY reveals some schools are forced to deal with staggeringly high teacher vacancies. WHYY's Kevin McCory reports on the disastrous effects that has on learning.
The percentage of teacher vacancies that actually get filled at some schools is mind-bogglingly low. During the first 4 months of this academic year, hundreds of daily teacher absences at these schools have attracted only a handful of subs. District data obtained by WHYY through a Right to Know request shows that in that time, more than 50 Philadelphia district schools couldn't get subs to fill in more than 10% of the time. That was true for Edison High School in North Philadelphia, where there were more than 700 daily teacher absences from September through December.
It was really bumpy in the beginning, where there just wasn't anybody coming.
Sydney Coffin teaches English at Edison.
It just becomes really difficult for the kids more than anybody. I mean, teachers get stressed, yeah, definitely. But the kids get stressed too, because they don't know who they can rely on.
The decline in subs comes after the district outsourced finding fill-ins to Source for Teachers. The Cherry Hill-based firm was awarded a $34 million contract last June, despite no experience staffing a large urban district. Source for Teachers pledged to deliver a 75% fill rate on the first day of school and 90% by January 1st. The firm fell well short of those promises. And though the overall rate has continued to climb, it's still worse than the 65% mark that the district posted last year on its own.
There was one class that I covered in the beginning of the year, maybe six, seven times. They never have had a teacher.
The daily substitute problem has been severely compounded by the high number of open positions and long-term vacancies that remain unfilled in Philadelphia schools. Coffin says it hinders learning and harms the climate at Edison, specifically for freshmen who've lacked the stability and authority of consistent teachers.
Ninth grade is a particularly tough time where they're making that transition from middle school to high school, and they end up kind of not knowing what their place is. And when they don't know what their place is, they tend to wander. So there were a lot of fights.
The district had hoped that Source for Teachers would find better ways to attract subs to its most impoverished schools, which has long been a problem. But it hasn't happened. Some say it's even harder for the private company to do so, because when the district was in charge, subs received higher pay and enjoyed union protections. At Blaine Elementary in Strawberry Mansion, Source for Teachers filled six substitute positions for 363 teacher absences. But Blaine principal Janine Powell says Source for Teachers' track record actually isn't too much out of step with prior years.
We already know that we have to pull, you know, a prep teacher. We have to do coverages for teachers. You know, that's just a natural, normal thing.
Superintendent William Height has expressed displeasure with Source for Teachers' performance, and financial penalties have been levied. However, district spokesman Fernando Gallard says Height decided against canceling the contract.
We are not where we should be, but we are seeing some improvement.
Even if the rate continues to get better, educators say that much of the damage done this year will not be easily repaired. In times of austerity budgets, bare-bones staffing, and large class sizes, the persistence of long-term vacancies and the lack of daily substitutes are two more stressors on a long, overwhelming list, says Sydney Coffin.
Last year, last period every day, I had 51 kids in my classroom learning junior English. Kids slipped through the cracks. I lost two of those juniors over the summer to homicide, and that is not lost on me. That as much as you do for all these kids, you're going to lose some. Those were not the kids I expected to lose, but I know I'm losing kids every day because there are just too many of them.
Coffin, who runs Edison's poetry team, was particularly close with one of the victims, a budding poet named Tyrone Tillman, who was slain in a hit and run in July.
We have such complicated relationships with students. We're not their parents, but as a kid, he used to call me dad. He'd joke around, you know? But we get attached to our students, and he's one.
Dealing with that loss has only made Coffin reflect deeper on all the students who he feels the system is letting down. But despite the underperforming Source for Teachers contract and the host of other challenges, Coffin remains wearily determined.
I love it. It's the greatest job on earth. Kennedy said about the Peace Corps, it's the toughest job you'll ever love. This is the closest thing to the Peace Corps. It's in America. It's right here. It's where I live.
Kevin McCrory, WHYY News.
Turning to today's headlines, talks are scheduled to continue between rail worker unions and New Jersey Transit as a strike deadline looms. Union officials say the two sides will meet tomorrow. They last gathered about a week ago. The unions have authorized a strike at 12:01 a.m. March 13th if no agreement is reached. At issue, higher health insurance premiums and wage increases. The American Civil Liberties Union plans to appeal a recent federal court ruling that citizens can sometimes be stopped from recording police officers on duty. The appeal concerns a ruling issued Friday in Philadelphia by U.S. District Court Judge Mark Kearney. Kearney ruled that citizens do not have an unfettered right to record police activity, noting police are free to stop such recordings unless the person shooting the video announces that he or she is recording as a challenge or protest of officers' actions. Mary Catherine Roper, one of the ACLU attorneys involved in the case, says the ruling reduces the ability of the public to monitor police activity. 40 degrees, cloudy skies at 6:17. You're listening to NewsWorks Tonight on WHYY. The evening forecast, cloudy, breezy, falling back to 34 degrees. Sunny tomorrow, Friday's high 40. Sunny Saturday up to 40 degrees, and ahead to Sunday, sunny, a warming trend, high near 60. Still ahead, nearly 40 years after lead paint was banned, Pennsylvania is still trying to figure out who should pay to remove it.
We have had landlords shutter up the building. The lead abatement could actually be more costly than the value of the property.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Farmers raise the animals and grow the crops and feed the rest of us, but it is harder than it used to be.
Till the marketplace wants to incentivize me or send a clear signal, I'm going to sit on my hands, continue to raise the pigs as my father and grandfather did.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, American Farmers and the Food Conversation in this country. That is next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
The Barnes Foundation supports WHYY and challenges art lovers to uncover fascinating stories behind masterpieces in the Barnes Collection. From gamblers and skirt chasers to fashionistas and brats, paintings by Van Gogh, Matisse, Renoir, and more tell irresistible tales. Also on view for a limited time, Picasso, The Great War, Experimentation, and Change. Collection and exhibition tours available daily. Tickets at barnesfoundation.org.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Pennsylvania and Delaware voters go to the polls April 26th. Garden State residents wait till June 7th to weigh in on the presidential primaries, and by most measures, it will be all over but the shouting at that juncture. Let's look at the primary process with Rutgers University presidential historian David Greenberg, author of the new book entitled Republic of Spin, An Inside History of the American Presidency. Professor, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks.
Now, let's note you spoke today at the National Constitution Center. Nowhere in the Constitution, though, does it mention this presidential primary process.
No, and in fact, political parties aren't in the Constitution either. Our political process evolved a lot through the 19th century as more people got the vote, as the parties emerged to represent different interests. By the early 20th century, there was a real sense that the party bosses had too strong a stranglehold over the nominations. And that's where we first began to see presidential primaries as a way of giving the power back to the people.
And the states have a lot of latitude in structuring the primaries. Are they closed? Are they open? Is it winner take all? Apportionment?
That's exactly right. I mean, there is no single kind of national blueprint. So we have this very messy system where different regional preferences, different traditions prevail in each state.
Let's move on to the Republic of Spin. I presume you're not referring to 33 and a third.
No. You know, spin is a term that came into the vogue really in the 80s for kind of the whole mess of messaging and image making that now has come to define modern politics. And so this book is a history of the White House spin machine, both on the campaign trail and from the Oval Office. and how candidates and presidents have learned to develop and then to use new machinery to shape their messages, to shape their images, because political power has come increasingly to reside with the people.
And indeed, to communicate, you have to broadcast that message. Let's note, prior to being a historian, you were a full-time journalist. To what extent is the media complicit in this action?
Well, the media, journalists have always been a central part of the spin machine. From the president's point of view, you know, the journalist's job is simply to tell the public what he, the president, or the candidate is saying. From the journalist's point of view, their job is to not be a mere conveyor belt for official messages, but to tell the people what to really think, to analyze it, to contextualize it, to offer some counterspin.
How has the advent of Twitter and other social media changed that system?
Well, that's only really widened the field. So now we have journalists tweeting, we have politicians tweeting, but we also have lots of individual citizens who will tweet, who will post on other social media. And while they certainly don't have the same power with their megaphones, they certainly have the opportunity to get their ideas into the media discourse as well in ways that, you know, used to maybe be confined to the letter to the editor page. So we have a kind of wider and probably more cacophonous journalistic landscape than we used to as well.
But then does that cacophony drown out the initial message intended by the candidate and his or her team?
I mean, if you look how candidates, particularly in the last two or three decades, despite having all these media channels at their disposal, have often really struggled to get their message out because there are so many other voices out there. So it becomes much harder for a president. He can't simply say, I'm going to give a speech tonight from the Oval Office and expect that everybody's going to listen.
For the purposes of an inside history of the American presidency, where does the modern election cycle start?
I really started with 1896. This is the year that William Jennings Bryan, as the Democrats' nominee, first goes stumping around the country. You know, people don't often realize in the 19th century, candidates stood for election. They didn't personally campaign on their own behalf. And then comes Theodore Roosevelt, who, as William McKinley's vice presidential nominee, does this for McKinley. So he goes traveling around giving speeches. And soon, by the 20th century, this becomes the burden on presidential candidates.
Professor, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Sure, my pleasure.
Rutgers University presidential historian David Greenberg, author of the new book entitled Republic of Spin, An Inside History of the American Presidency. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. If your home was built prior to 1978, there are likely layers of lead paint on the walls. Pennsylvania ranks fourth in the nation for the most homes built before then. Decades after lead paint was banned, Keystone Crossroads' Eleanor Klibanoff reports we're still asking whose job it is to clean up the mess.
When David Rosner was a kid, he'd go into his grandfather's garage and mix up cans of paint.
I can still remember, you know, just sticking a stick in it to mix it up and hitting halfway down a solid mass of hard stuff, and that was lead.
Rosner, a professor of public health at Columbia University and the author of the book Lead Wars, now knows the dangers contained in that can of paint. Exposure to lead through dust and chipping paint can cause permanent developmental delays in children under the age of six.
It became apparent in the 1970s. Children who had lead in their blood did substantially worse on various kinds of neurological tests and IQ tests and behavioral tests, and also did worse in school.
Lead was banned in paint in 1978. 70% of Pennsylvania's current housing stock was already built by then. And while lead poisoning has declined statewide, in 2014, there were still over 13,000 children with elevated blood lead levels. And that's only testing 14% of children in the state. We've had 40 years to remove or permanently encapsulate all that lead paint, but that hasn't happened. Vicki Kissler, the director of the Allentown Bureau of Health, says many homeowners can't afford the remediation, which can cost thousands of dollars.
We have had landlords shutter up the building.
the lead abatement could actually be more costly than the value of the property. We have had homeowners sell their home. They can't do the abatement, and then they have to disclose that it has lead, so it would be difficult to resell it.
Over the years, Pennsylvania has helped finance remediation through a hodgepodge of federal grants. But that money recently dried up. The EPA stopped providing grants in 2010. HUD did not renew a grant the state had received since 2000. And when Pennsylvania changed how they applied to the CDC, they lost that funding as well. Individual cities still receive some federal grant funding. The state now puts $2 million towards the lead issue each year, according to Health Secretary Karen Murphy.
We have a hotline. People are able to call in and we provide electronic materials or counseling. We also have community health nurses. When they get the reported elevated lead levels, they begin case management with children. It is also to really educate people on how the elevated lead levels occur.
Right now, state funding focuses on education, not remediation. So Kistler from the Allentown Health Bureau says unless a child's lead levels are extreme, interim solutions are what they're able to offer.
So we actually deliver them cleaning supplies. We tell the parent to wash the child's hands more frequently, wash the toys, keep the floors and windowsills clean, and we work with that family and the pediatrician to try to implement that plan of action and then retest and see if the levels go down.
That can work, but it also means that lead paint remains on the walls until the next family moves in and starts the process over again. It's not surprising we've gone 40 years and still have cases of lead poisoning across the state. But Kistler says,
there isn't enough money in the world to remove all the lead that we have in our communities.
Remember David Rosner, the guy who used to mix paint in his grandfather's garage? He says society's been paying the bill for 40 years.
If the state's setting up programs, if cities are setting up programs, if the federal government has programs, children are paying the price, if schools are being forced to get special ed teachers, if everyone's paying for the cost of what this industry did, except the industry itself.
Rosner has testified in lawsuits against paint companies like Dutch Boy, ConAgra, and Sherwin-Williams. In 2013, they were ordered to pay California cities $1.1 billion towards lead remediation. The paint companies appealed the decision, but if the industry ends up paying, that would set a precedent for other states to try the same. Eleanor Klibanoff, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media collaboration focusing on Pennsylvania cities, their problems, and potential solutions. WHYY leads the four-station partnership. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas, with help today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.